order.
And I'll bring my mic up here so you can hear me. Members who are here will take their seats. We're not at quorum yet, so we'll wait to approve the minutes. And I'll just explain, I haven't sat in this seat in this committee, and I'm honored to have the opportunity to share this meeting. Representative Mariani asked me to chair because I've had the privilege of following a good portion of the discussion, some of which we'll be hearing today. So, and that also gives Representative Mariani a chance to sit in a more reflective position and maybe participate more fully as a member. So, so that's the reason that you have an unusual face in the seat today. And as I said, we'll let the minutes go for now. But today we're going to be hearing from Ken Pickell, who's the director of College Readiness Consortium at the University of Minnesota. And later he'll be joined at the podium by Dirk Mattson, who's the director of assessment and testing from the Minnesota Department of Education. And today is more of a preparation for a report. If you remember last session, we spent quite a bit of time discussing assessment, and we changed some of our policies on high school assessment. And as a result of those changes, we convened a task force, and we asked the Consortium on Career and College Readiness, the Policy Institute, to convene a task force to make some recommendations to us. They will be reporting to the commissioner, and the commissioner will be reporting to us on those recommendations next week. But because of the richness of that discussion, it was thought that this session like this, where we informally expose some of the major elements of the discussion, would help prepare us better for that report. So that's the purpose of the discussion today. So I hope you'll find it informative, interesting, challenging, and take good notes, because you'll need all your best thoughts next week when we do hear the report from the commissioner. With that, I would ask Ken Pickell to come up to the podium and welcome his observations and insights that from the last several months of hard work that I know this group has done.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Good morning. My name is Kent Pickell, and as the chair noted, I head up an organization at the University of Minnesota called the College Readiness Consortium, and I have been co-chairing this task force since May of last year with Dr. Dirk Mattson, who's our state assessment director and who will be joining me in a second. I want to say at the outset that the goal here today is emphatically not to share any recommendation, because we're not done. In fact, our final meeting is this afternoon. As Representative Breinert noted, we'll be making a recommendation to Commissioner Segrin, and she will in turn make her recommendation for all of you to consider. So what Representative Mariani asked me to do was begin laying the groundwork for this, frankly, very, very big and very imminent decision that you all need to make, with just giving you some of the lessons learned about testing and accountability, which is to say how you hold people responsible, students in this case in particular, for performance on the tests. Some of the things that we've learned over almost 8 months of looking at these issues. So I'm going to go at a pretty good clip here, and then we can have Dirk join me for the discussion and the conversation. So let's do a little bit of history here very quickly. How did we get here, and where did this start? Our current state high school test, as you all know, is called the GRAD, the Graduation Required Assessments for Diploma. And these are the outcomes that were in place most recently as of last year, as you faced some important decisions about what to do with our high school assessment accountability system. You can see we give a ninth grade writing test, and you can see there the passing rates over the past 3 years. We give a 10th grade reading test, and you can see there in 2009, 78% of the kids met that standard. And then there's the 11th grade math test, which was given for the first time for accountability purposes in 2009, and 57% of the students ultimately met that standard. And as you'll recall, it was that level of performance on the math test that led the legislature and ultimately the governor to put a pause in place for 5 years that does not require students to hit that cut score to earn a diploma. Getting under the hood of that data on the GRAD, though, is very, very important, because it looks like this. This is the performance on that 11th grade math test if you break it down and differentiate it. And you can see here that 30% of our American Indian students, 52% of our Asian Pacific Islanders, 21% of our African American group of students, 31% of our Hispanic students and 63% of our white students met that standard. And so had you not made that decision to put in place that reprieve, almost 80% of the African-American students in the state would have had 1 year from the end of their junior year to the end of their senior year to make up that ground in mathematics to graduate on time. So that's a quick snapshot of the data that brought us to this point on the graduation test. And most good policy problems, you had the wisdom to convene a task force. And so that's the work that I've been doing with Dirk for the last number of months. You authorized that task force in May of 2009. We've had about 20 people on the group, most of whom have been secondary and post-secondary educators, a diverse group of educators, but candidly, in retrospect, not as many voices from outside education as might have been useful, though I think we've done a good job of attempting to reach out beyond the task force. We solicited feedback over the web from various stakeholders, and we thought maybe we'd get 50 to 60 comments. We got well over 250, some of them pages long. We've also conducted a process in partnership with the Citizens League that has very recently concluded, where we've done focus groups in schools to work very closely with very different types of students and educators to actually get their input on the proposal. We've spent a lot of time trying not to just make judgments based on our personal history and perspectives. We've looked at data and research. We've tried to develop a set of guiding principles that ought to govern the creation of this new system. And we're in the guts of coming up with some detailed recommendations for the commissioner and then you to consider. As I mentioned, our last meeting is literally today at 3 p.m. And we have a lot of consensus on a lot of points in a recommendation, but a few big issues yet hopefully to resolve. So our charge to the task force, though, and this is really the point of departure for my brief presentation here, the charge was if the grad system was aligned with ensuring that students master minimum competency on our state standards, which is our current K-12 standards, our charge from you and from the commissioner was to create a system of assessment and accountability that actually is aligned with college and career readiness so that kids are really ready for the next step. In a perfect world, the theory goes like this, that your last high school test is your first post-secondary test, that you have such tight alignment between the tests and the systems that you really create a seamless system that helps all students get ready to succeed in a technical college, a two-year college, or a four-year college or university. But that raises an important question. Why? Why should college and career readiness be the objective? And I hope you'll permit me to take you through a few slides that hopefully make that case for you. And if you take nothing else from this presentation this morning, I hope you'll take the sense that there does need to be a sense of urgency about getting all of our students to that bar. That doesn't answer the critical question that we've been grappling with on the task force of how you do that. So this one picture is one that I use a lot in my work with students. And I'll tell you, especially for junior high and early high school students, this picture, which is very familiar to many of us because we live it, is a big shock. And you know what it says. It says that the more you can learn, the more you can earn in this economy. And the reason this picture, I think, is powerful is that it also puts on the same access of educational attainment, unemployment. And so we see that if we don't get students to higher level of knowledge and skills, their chances of earning a living wage and supporting a family in this economy are not good. And as many of you also know, the differentials between those bars have been increasing rapidly since the 1970s. Those who have more education are doing better than ever, and those who have what used to be an adequate education to support a family, in particular a high school diploma, are not succeeding in this economy, in particular in our current economy. So let's take a quick look, though, at a little bit of history. The bar up until this system, including with the grad system that all of you faced the difficult decisions with last spring, the bar was on high school graduation. And this is what international high school graduation rates looked like in the 1960s. And you can see the highest bar over there is the United States. We were number one in high school completion. In fact, the United States was the first developed country in the world, really the first country, that made high school universal. In Europe and in Japan, high school was still an elite proposition that only affluent families did. And everybody else stopped at what we would call primary education. But by the 1970s, the rest of the world was starting to get the picture. And you can see the United States made a little bit of progress in the 70s, but the white lines show you that suddenly the rest of the world began to get very, very focused on the completion of a high school credential. By the 1980s, you see the United States made no progress in our high school graduation rates compared to the 70s, but the yellow bars show that the rest of the world continued to get to the bar that we had hit in the 60s and 70s. And finally, in the 1990s, you can see that essentially the United States' advantage in high school completion had been erased. Over the course of those four decades, we went from being number one in the world in high school completion to being number 13. Over the same time period, Korea went from being number 27 in the world to number one. Now, the important point there is they did not import new Koreans during those years. They produced dramatic improvements in the educational attainment of their people. Now, admittedly, they were recovering from a war in the 1950s, so that was a very low base. But nonetheless, whether it was Singapore or Korea, simply having been devastated in a war doesn't guarantee that kind of improvement over time. But just as the 20th century education race was focused on high school completion, here's the focus that has been the emphasis on our deliberations on the College and Career Ready Task Force that is nearing its conclusion. This is college completion, the completion of a undergraduate degree, the equivalent of what we call a BA or BS. And I want to emphasize that's not the right route for every kid, but it's one goal that that many countries are increasingly focused on. So we could actually have a very long and interesting policy discussion on this access, which is the cost of your higher ed system. But in the interest of time and focus, I'm not going to talk about that at all today. And the focus of these few brief graphs should be on the bottom axis, and that's the supply of college graduates that your system is producing. Again, this is national data for the countries I'm going to show you. So the big white bar is the United States. The size of your dot is actually also the cost of your system. So again, that's a very important discussion that we're not going to go into right now, the cost of your higher education system. So this is 1995. This is not ancient history. I was teaching high school at the time in Bloomington, and so I remember these years pretty recently. There's the United States in 1995. To give you a couple other reference points, there's Japan, there's Sweden, and there's Germany. So you see, like high school completion in the 20th century, the United States, as recently as the mid-90s, had a sizable lead in college completion rates. Fast forward to 2000, 5 years later, and here's what had happened. The United States had made a bit of progress, but look what happened to the rest of those dots. The rest of them had caught up in terms of college completion rates internationally. And you can see the dot where the United States was in 1995. There's Australia. The world, however, did not stop in 2000, despite what some of the Y2K bug folks predicted, or even some of the millennial folks, and it continued apace. And so here's what happened in 2001, 2002, 2003, 2004, 2005. Suddenly, we have the United States there in the, I think you can nicely call it the middle of the pack. There's Australia, having made dramatic progress with a strategy that emphasizes both academic success and paying for higher education. And Sweden. And so there you get the international picture. So this, I took the time to show you this because I hope that you have a sense of urgency that those of us on the task force developed over the course of our months of work together around improving the post-secondary attainment of our students generally and of our students of color and low-income students in particular, who right now are least likely to succeed in higher education. So all of that was national and international data that I showed you. Let me just quickly turn to how are things in Minnesota, and is it really still the good life, and how are things going? The best measure that we have actually of college readiness rates in Minnesota are benchmarks that are developed by the ACT exam. What ACT does is they look at how students scored on their high school test, which 70% of Minnesota high school graduates take on average every year, and then they compare their performance to their GPAs as undergraduates. And students who have a 75% chance of getting a C or better or a 50% chance of getting a B or better are considered college ready, and they look and see what was the level at which they scored in high school. So let's take a look at our best current measure, not a perfect measure by any means, of college readiness rates in Minnesota before I conclude with just a few of the lessons that we've learned in looking at this data and research and our conversations together. So here are the college readiness benchmarks overall, and there you can see Minnesota compared to the country. You can see that for kids who graduated with all hitting the benchmarks, Minnesota kids in all four subject areas, English, algebra, social science, and biology, 32% hit the benchmarks in all four subject areas in Minnesota, 23% nationally. And then you can see the breakdowns there by subject area. 78% of our kids in Minnesota hit the college readiness benchmark in English, 57% in college algebra, 65% in social science, history, political science, and 39% in biology. But once again, we need to look underneath the data, and the story isn't necessarily a good one. Here's what happens when you break down that college readiness data by race. You can see there that while all students in Minnesota were at a 78% readiness rate hitting the benchmark in English, our African American students were 39%, and our Native American students were 60%, and you can see the other percentages for other groups. So that's the story broken down for English. There's the story broken down for algebra, where again we see very different levels of college readiness among our ACT test takers in Minnesota. And finally, in biology. So again, we see very discrepant outcomes when we break down the data. Now, I know all of us are concerned about those discrepancies simply because we're concerned about the kids who are inside those bar graphs. I think it's also important to note that the populations in our K-12 schools that are growing the fastest are the students in the groups that are on the shorter ends, that are in the shorter bars. And so there is an urgent need for a sense of urgency about this work. But what do we do, given that we know this isn't Lake Wobegon? What are some of the solutions? And that's what we've been grappling with, guided by that data. I'm going to give you now five lessons I've learned in doing this work about assessment and five lessons about accountability. I want to emphasize that I've tried to stay pretty close to things I think most of the task force members would agree upon, but these aren't five lessons that the task force has voted on. They will be voting on their recommendation to the commissioner, and which she'll be transmitting her recommendation to you. But these are some general observations that I thought would be helpful to you as you look forward to making this very big decision that is coming quite soon. So assessment, testing. What are some of the things that I think members ought to have in mind as you go forward? First, there are basically three types of high school, what we call an exit exam. And I'm going to go fairly quickly here, and in the questions and answers, and Dr. Mattson can join me, we can come back and probe these at whatever level of detail is helpful to you. But there's basically three food groups of tests that kids get to get out of high school in the United States today. The first is what we've taken to calling a comprehensive exam. That's a test like the grad test. It measures the content that students learn over several years of school at one fixed point in time, like 9th grade in our writing test, 10th grade in our reading test, 11th grade in our math test. So that's a comprehensive test. It measures multiple years of student learning. The second type is called end of course. This is like the final exam that many of you took through your high school and post-secondary years, which summarizes the learning that the student did in that class. And so an end-of-course test is developed by the state or some external body, but it's given at the end of Algebra 2, Biology, U.S. History. It's very similar to the kind of exams that an advanced placement student takes or an international baccalaureate student takes at the conclusion of a particular AP or IB test. And then the third type of exit exam is a college entrance test. There are a number of states that actually give the ACT or fewer that give the SAT, which is the test that colleges use to determine eligibility for admission. Some states are using that as a high school exit exam as well. We talked a lot about the pros and cons of these various test types here, and again, if it's interesting to you, I would be glad to come back, and Dirk can join me in talking about those in detail. I'll just say in summary, one of the things that is on comprehensive tests, a virtue of them is that they are broad. They do measure multiple years of learning. But the breadth can mean you don't get depth. You don't go as deeply into particular bodies of content that are very critical. With end-of-course tests, you zero in on a particular course, and so you get depth, but you may sacrifice some breadth. There seems to be a sense among the assessment community that end-of-course tests are a more reliable indicator of college and career readiness and more useful for improving teaching and learning, but there's not research that confirms that at this point. College entrance tests have the virtue of really making that last high school test your first college test, but it's very difficult to adapt that test to your state academic standards because the ACT or SAT was not designed to measure Minnesota's academic standards, and so you probably have to spend a good bit of money adapting that test to measure your state's K-12 standards if that is important to you and as is frankly required right now by No Child Left Behind. So those are the three main types of tests that we have thought about and have grappled with over our months together. Second point, no test is perfect.
Mr. Pickell,
yes.
We have a question here from Representative Mariani.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and actually, Mr. Pickell, it's more an observation than a question, because I think you, in your last description of the three exit exam possibilities, you zeroed in on what I think is one of the sort of constant tensions that hang over us here as policymakers. There are several, but one is this struggle with wanting to create and forward public policy that, in regards to testing, that either promotes instructional, quality, moves the dime forward in terms of having instruments that inform that process versus something that just something that gives us an overall sense of how the system and at times how the student is doing relative to this gold standard of college readiness. And I think perhaps the holy grail for us is trying to figure out whether or not we can accomplish both of those through the use of one instrument or some kind of combination of instruments. And it's probably self-evident, but I think it's important to note that oftentimes when I get engaged in these conversations, we jump into conversations without a upfront agreement on what our expected outcome should be. Are we guided by something that is meant to be a powerful tool to inform instruction versus something that gives us a sense of the efficacy of the student and or the system? And I know that that could be a false choice as well, but nonetheless, I think that that's a very dominant frame out of which a number of us operate from. So I just wanted to accentuate that point, and I know we struggled with that in the group as well.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, it's a critical point, and let me, as I want to do, and then Dirk will come up here and really explain it in a sophisticated way, sort of simplify it. If a kid doesn't do well on a comprehensive exam in 11th grade, for instance, it may have been content that he or she didn't master that was taught in 8th grade that was the problem. Going back to reverse engineer that to figure out how we improve the teaching is not impossible, but it literally is a very complex task. I mean, you may literally be going back to look at what didn't happen in the junior high if you're sitting there in a high school. Whereas with an end of course test, if the kid does not do well on the Algebra 2 exam, often you go right for that course and that teacher. Now, there's pros and cons about that. So the notion of the usefulness of the two tests for improving teaching and learning, the two kinds of tests, is a very important distinction. But there's not a clear consensus or sort of research base about which is better. But to some extent, if you're measuring multiple years of learning, identifying the source of success or problems is more complex than if you have a test that's going to be banded.
Mr. Pickell,
yeah.
Just before we go on, we have a quorum, so I'd like to ask for a motion to approve the minutes of the February 11th meeting.
So moved.
Thank you. Representative McFarland has moved the approval of the minutes for February 11th. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? The minutes are approved, and you can continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I'm moving at a clip here in the interest of time, and we can either stop it as you have or come back to these points. Second lesson learned is that, and it's very important to keep in mind, no test is perfect. If our goal is to measure college and career readiness, and you set a single cut score, some kids who score below that cut score are actually going to go on and do fine in college and careers. Some kids who score above that cut score are going to go on and not do well. Now, those problems with testing can be mitigated in a number of ways by the test design and by allowing the student to take the test multiple times. But when we're talking about holding individual students accountable for their learning, it's very important to understand that there is measurement error inherent in any test. There's what you call false positives or false negatives. It's true of a test to grant a license in a profession or to grant a high school diploma. And it's something to keep in mind. The where you set that cut score is going to increase or decrease your chance of having false positives or false negatives. A way to think about it is that the cut score is a point, but real readiness is a slope. And some kids who are below that point are actually going to go on and do okay, and some kids who are above that point are going to struggle. And so being aware of and mitigating measurement error when we're talking about high-stakes testing for individual kids is something that we've talked about quite a bit on the task force. And we may want to, in the discussion period, get into a discussion of some of the research around stereotype threat, which is to say students in certain groups may perform less well on standardized tests because of a perception of testing itself, which is a research-based finding that might be interested to talk about. Again, something that can be mitigated but not eliminated. Third point on testing. This was an interesting finding for me because I've sat on the state standard-setting panels for a number of years in both reading and math. And here's the key point. In the past, we've set performance levels, which is to say the bands that defined how kids, the ranges that defined how kids do for below basic, proficient, above proficient, and the cut scores, which is to say a specific point for accountability purposes. We've set those in the past by bringing together mostly educators with some input from policymakers, business, and others, and asking them for their professional judgment in a very sophisticated process, how good is good enough. But an important finding on our task force was that trust that the professional judgment of those educators, and it's a very carefully managed process and they're great folks, but it trusts that they really know what kids know and need to be able to do after high school. There have been very few efforts to do what that ACT data that I just showed you has tried to do, which is actually to correlate the performance on a K-12 test with life after the K-12 system. And so to some extent, we've in the past at least been rooted in professional judgment as opposed to correlating with actual outcomes. Now, that is it's a more practical and less expensive way to do it, to bring educators together and look at how good is good enough in math, in reading. It does not mean necessarily that you could point statistically to a likelihood that this score on your 11th grade math test is going to mean this level of performance in college or a career. Fourth point, this is one on which our task force really, held hands and sang kumbaya and had great agreement, which is that there is a lot of power in putting together short diagnostic formative tests that are aligned with the test at the end of the rainbow. Dipstick tests that allow you to actually identify troubles and areas of strength before you take the final summative test. This is the kind of thing that in the business world, friends who work in companies live all the time with data dashboards and early warning indicators. And that we had a lot of consensus on our group that both at the district and state levels, creating a really robust system of assessment and accountability needs to include these precursor tests that help individual classroom teachers, principals, and district leaders identify the skills students need to develop before the moment of truth and accountability. And a final point on testing before I give you a few quick thoughts on accountability, and that's that we really are on the cusp of a revolution in testing. We're on the cusp of a revolution because of improvements in both measurement, in the building of tests, and in technology, where tests are increasingly becoming adaptive, which is to say it tests the kid's knowledge at this level, and then it takes the kid up a bit and down a bit, and is more and more likely to identify after multiple attempts the kid really does or doesn't understand a particular skill set. In other countries, the future is here today in some respects, where they're using a hybrid of an end-of-course exam in places like Singapore and Hong Kong and New Zealand, coupled with performance assessments, which are actually classroom-based tasks that are designed outside the school but that are performed by kids and scored using rubrics that are also developed outside the school. And so testing in some of those countries is a hybrid between what we would think of as a standardized test and more of a performance-based assessment at the classroom and school level. Similarly, computer-based testing in the future is clearly going to be, if anybody's looking for a place to invest in the future of education, I would say the future of the testing industry is a good place to put your money if you pick the right company. Let me turn to a couple other points on accountability, which is to say how you hold people accountable for the assessments, and then conclude with two final points before our, Dr. Mattson joins me. The first is, again, one that seems obvious, but I would submit at least that in a lot of the design of a lot of accountability systems, it's one we haven't put in place, which is an effective accountability system includes both pressure and support. Any of us who've ever been on an athletic team or been in a performance know this is true at the individual level. It's true for accountability systems as well. You need constructive and appropriate pressure, but you also need the support to reach the outcomes. Similarly, you want to have sanctions and incentives. If it's all carrot and no stick or all stick and no carrot, the system really risks not achieving its intended outcomes. Second, and this is a point that gets very, very difficult when the discussions get heated and complex, which is this. Holding individual kids accountable for their learning is different than holding schools and systems accountable for their learning. The two should be aligned, because you don't want to have kids facing requirements and sanctions that are at odds with the way their schools and their districts are measured. But the two are distinct. And often in these discussions, the question of holding individual kids accountable to improve the system comes up. Now, you may want to do that, but you should be very, very clear that in holding students accountable to improve the system, there's an impact on that individual student who may or may not have had the instruction and the opportunity to learn that he or she needed to meet the requirement. And so thinking differently about individual student accountability and school and system accountability to me seems quite important. And it's not to say you shouldn't do both. It's just to say to be very clear about the differences between the two. Third, there's not a ton of research on this stuff, though it's like testing itself, it's a growth industry. And some of the best scholars around the country are starting to look at this issue of exit exams. The research that does exist suggests some reason to be cautious. There are a number of studies that suggest that the exit exams that have high stakes for kids do reduce dropout rates and have some negative impacts without benefits in student achievement or wages in the labor market. I will say those studies are limited in number. They have some assumptions that you can really quarrel with if you unpack them. But they're important beginnings of actually figuring out what really works. This is not an area like early childhood where we know if it's done right, it really works. This is an area where it's less clear, but I think it's worth quoting, I think it was Carl Sagan who said, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Simply because the research here doesn't indicate that this works doesn't mean that it doesn't work, but it is reason for caution. Policymakers in some other states, notably Massachusetts, that have achieved very good educational improvements over the last decade have identified exit examinations as a critical part of their success. So the point is, we're not in an area here where there's consensus among the research wonks in what works and what doesn't work. I think over the next decade, we're going to learn a lot about that right now. But at the present time, we and the research field and the policy field are finding our way.
Would you mind if I interrupted you?
No, I'm almost done, in fact.
Just on this issue, I think you're hitting on what many of us perceive as the edge that we stand on when we're making these policy decisions about accountability systems, because we're making them out into a timeline, you know, without the kind of evidence you're talking about. And the pressures for those decisions not being able to be research-based, I think, puts us in a very problematic place as policymakers. So I'm asking, I think we would benefit a great deal with very ongoing, updated, evidence-based, you know, information, so that our decisions are constantly informed by the very best information. Mm-hmm. And I'm asking you, how do you think we as policymakers can best do that?
Madam Chair, I would say that should be certainly part of the university's role and other institutions of higher education as well. One of the things that we need to do increasingly and increasingly well is attempt to connect you to the best current thinking on research in also a digestible way. I know none of you have time to read 80-page, I doubt you have time, to read 80-page summaries of graduation test studies. But I think that's a role that I know President Brunix is really eager to have us play in supporting your work around K-12 reform. So I think that's an effort. One of the challenges is I've tried to be fairly balanced here and not give you either my personal perspective or one side or the other. You bring a faculty member in here, which I'm not. I am an administrative staff at the U. You bring a faculty member in here, and he or she is going to give you the conclusions of their research, because that's what they get paid to do, and they're going to give you a perspective. And the challenge for you as policymakers is you bring another faculty member in, and often you're going to get a competing role, and that's the nature of higher education until you get to that point of growing consensus. Because exactly as you suggest, this is a new field of study. You're going to have to actually sift through the competing arguments at least for a number of years here and ultimately, I think, make a gut-level judgment call.
I appreciate that, but I would just say that I think we as legislators maybe need a little bit of a Jiminy Cricket on our shoulder, mm-hmm. calling attention to the objectivity of our judgment on a regular basis, especially when our decisions purport to be research-based and often aren't. So. All right. Go ahead. Sorry
Thank
for
you.
Interrupting.
No, appreciate that, Madam Chair. Fourth point, whether it's a business incenting student employee performance or the work they did in New York City to reduce crime dramatically over the last couple of decades, the state of the art in accountability systems is having multiple measures so that you're not just making a decision on a single indicator. Nice idea, hard in practice. Hard because it makes the system more complex, and it potentially makes the system more more expensive. That said, having multiple lenses through which to look at a student, because we all know none of us are simplistic beings, and college and career readiness is not a simple construct, is good. It's hard to do in practice, and many folks who hear the call for multiple measures and have sympathy for it worry that the multiple measures that you add to a test score are actually just a way of watering down or avoiding the tough conclusions of the test score. That's why in those other countries where I mentioned that they do a mix of standardized tests, the performance assessment piece is not just locally managed. It's very carefully managed outside the school. The teacher in the school does it, but they have performance tasks and rubrics and scoring that are often facilitated by their local Ministry of Education, and so that you don't just have sort of this is the test and this is whatever the individual teacher or school thinks is good enough. You have a productive tension between the two. But the field is pretty clear that multiple measures are an important way to come at these issues. And then the final point I'd make is one that I think our task force didn't start out with but came to, I think, be pretty collectively committed to over time, which is that the coherence of the system matters. I mean, in the end, this stuff is bewilderingly complex, but somehow we have to have a clear and consistent story behind this that you can tell to an individual kid, a parent, and a teacher. Which is to say, ultimately, if you can't sit down at that conference or at the ninth grade assembly in the high school and say, this is what you're going to have to do to earn a diploma in Minnesota, and here's why, and have that story make sense, we aren't going to get the real power in our accountability system. And if we have requirements that actually undercut our intentions, we also undermine the power of the system. It's outside the realm of testing, but the easiest example of this that I can give, I know is one that many of you dealt with in the last session. If on one hand we're urging all of our students to complete high school and go on to higher education, and yet give kids the authority to drop out of school before they're 18, there's a huge contradiction in the messages that we're sending to individual kids. That's an example of an incoherent system. Finish high school, go to college, but you can choose to drop out before the end of high school. So the coherence of the system matters. And let me leave you with just two final points. Here's final thought number one. It's an adage that gets quoted. I actually found it attributed to both George W. Bush and Barack Obama, which is that weighing the cow does not fatten him. that testing and measurement are critical, that we know they can be powerful aids in improving teaching and shining a light on difficult issues, but no kid ever got smarter from taking a test, and that ultimately it's the quality of instruction, the amount of time, and critically the quality of that teacher that is the big issue. And that leads to a second and final point, and that's that this is work for the long haul. I put that picture there because John Kennedy said to go to the moon before we really knew how. And I think saying we want all kids to be college and career ready by the end of high school is a similar goal. It's going to take a decade, and we don't know how to do it. Especially we don't know how to do it with our older teenagers and our older teenagers who are academically behind. But as I hope those bubble charts I showed you at the beginning of the presentation of America's college completion rates relative to our economic competitors convinced you, we need to figure it out. And we need to begin doing that with a sense of immediacy and urgency. So this is a man on the moon goal. It's going to take time. And I think as somebody who's been a teacher and administrator, I'd conclude with the point that in the focus groups we did with the Citizens League and other work I do in schools in general, the single biggest thing we hear is just pick a system and stick to it so we can work that system over time. That stability in state policy in this area is going to be really critical so that we can actually turn our attention to the actual improvement that we want to get on those outcomes, whatever decisions you make on them down the road. So, Madam Chair and members, that concludes this sort of whirlwind tour through a few observations that I've had through this work. And I know Dr. Mattson is here, and he can actually enlighten you on what the real research and state policy should look like, too.
I know Dr. Mattson wants to stay in the background, but I'd like to invite him up to the podium to join the discussion. He was a full partner in the process, co-chairing this task force. Obviously, members, you can see the quality of the discussion that has taken place over the last many months, and this discussion has informed the report that will eventually, and the recommendation that will eventually come to us, although it's not identical to that report, since the report will come from the commissioner. I'd like to take this opportunity to open this to questions members might have about. Yes, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to thank the testifier, and I apologize for missing the beginning of your presentation, but this is a topic I'm very interested in, and I wondered, with your experience, you mentioned you'd been a teacher as well, and looking at this, we have more data than ever before because of the testing and things that we do of our kids, but I'm not sure that schools or teachers or administrators or anyone involved in our education system knows how to effectively use all of that data in real time to help improve student performance. It seems to me we're taking all of these snapshots in time, and I'm not sure that that's translating into either different teaching methods or other things in the classroom to address deficiencies in student performance in a way that can show meaningful progress. Could you comment on that?
Mr. Pickell?
Madam Chair and members, that is a critical issue, and it's part of the revolution that's beginning, which is to say the use of data to improve instruction. Part of the challenge is, of course, professional development, making sure that classroom teachers understand what stainines are and value-added and growth and content strands. And we know that professional development on testing competes with professional development time for the actual teaching. And so it is a strategic use of time. One of the programs that we run at the university in partnership with our state administrators associations with support from the state and the Department of Education is called the Minnesota Principals Academy. We spend a lot of time over the course of a year, 2 or 3 days a month, working with principals on this challenge so that they really can get it. So that's a vague way of saying the issue is critical and there's no simple solution to it. I will tell you part of what I've seen as the sort of brave new world of testing is exactly getting at this issue. There's a program that I've seen called Burst Reading, and it's created by a company based in New York called Wireless Generation, and it's really quite amazing what happens. They actually take all of the individual student data on little kids learning to read, much of which you get for those of you who've worked in elementary schools or been elementary teachers, you know there's something called a running record, where the kid reads to you and you make marks with, okay, this student missed this sound, missed this meaning, missed this thing. We used to do them all on paper. What wireless generations technology does is the teacher sits there with a handheld device and automates that. That then is aggregated with that kid's performance in the past and his or her peers. And then what literally happens overnight is software actually crunches that data and produces a 10-day sequence of small group-based instruction that the teacher then uses to guide student learning on the diagnosed deficiencies that came out of that assessment tool. As this technology matures, it's going to be really extraordinary. It doesn't replace the teacher. It sets the teacher up to provide effective differentiated instruction using the assessment and using technology. That's in an area, which is to say early literacy, where actually we do know a lot about how to help little kids learn to read. The research there is pretty clear, unlike what I was just talking about with high school older kids. So that's one example of, I think, how over time these systems are actually going to make it quite possible to do those kinds of things. But that's a number of years off.
Thank you, Mr. Picot. Representative Depke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell me the name of that program again?
Yeah, the company's called Wireless Generation, yes. And their product is called Burst Colon Reading.
Thank you.
The idea is that the data bursts out these. And the teachers I've talked to in New York that actually have used it have said that the instructional plans that come out for the kids are actually very high quality. So that's what's exciting about it.
Thank you very much. I thought your presentation also earlier on the global level was just great. Very, very good. Do you have handouts or anything that you can give us on some of the information you gave us earlier in the presentation?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, I apologize I don't because I finished this at about 2 a.m., but I will be glad to get it to the committee administrator.
Great. Well, you're a hardworking presenter. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Somebody was up later than the legislators.
Yeah,
working. My question is for Dr. Mattson, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, after this task force, what changes, if any, you will be recommending for our state testing regime based on the knowledge.
Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, I think we haven't come to the point where we have crafted any legislation yet, although I anticipate that with the working group and perhaps even a small subset of that, we would be proposing, if the proposal as it currently sits, and as Kent said, we're yet to meet this afternoon, but it would have several substantive changes, moving to end of course assessment, some kind of sunset provision for the grad, language in there potentially about interim assessments or formative assessments. There's interesting conversations about that. So I anticipate that there will be some legislative language that would be proposed in the next coming weeks, not specifically even from the executive branch, but hopefully as a joint effort of this group coming to agreement on that language.
Yes, Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then, Dr. Mattson, any inside tips on which testing company we should invest in?
Madam Chair, Representative Greiling, I don't believe it would be appropriate for me to respond to that question.
Thank you, Dr. Mattson. Representative Dietrich.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. For Mr. Mattson, I have a question, and it deals with technology. And I personally believe that technology is going to be the tool that can transform our classrooms, not necessarily reform them, but transform them into data-driven, individualized, and more motivated learning. But for me, at least from the knowledge that I have and that I have gathered about our schools, that for me what that means is that we have another inequity in our state, and that is the access to technology. Can you comment statewide where we are at in technology and what kind of a platform we have statewide and where we are going and what is the plan on how to get all students access to high-speed wireless technology?
Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Representative Dietrich, the question certainly is broader than just assessment, as you identify. However, in assessment, certainly that is, as Kent talks about, kind of we're on the cusp of the next generation. That certainly is where assessment is heading. That certainly is where new item types are heading, that we're not just taking the paper and putting it on computer. That is the most inefficient use of computer possible. We have done in the assessment division several surveys, and it seems that we've done a multitude of surveys to try and determine where we are statewide. There's another group that I believe it's Representative Winkler and Senator Bonoff serve on, looking at just that issue of equity within access for high-speed internet and computers, so forth. It is a very nebulous number at best, and I really wouldn't have I'd be speculating to be able to say, well, it's X amount of kids per computer, etc. Really, in testing anyway, that is where the choke point is. It isn't about do they have the right Internet Explorer or Flash, etc. It is having enough seats to get enough kids through there. That is why, to some degree, now the end of course conversation makes this a little more challenging. We are looking in our 3-8 program to expand that window considerably, and we've got, it's a whole other topic of conversation. And in the meantime, try and provide some paper alternatives to be able to process this through. But you're exactly right. That means that the students who are taking the paper alternative are not getting access to that more innovative item type that may be able to give us a greater depth of understanding of what that student knows. So I share that concern with you. I think that Minnesota Education Technology Task Force, I believe, that I mentioned Representative Winkler's on, has conducted and continues to conduct some surveys to try and identify not only where are we, but what is the long-term strategy to do this. Just quickly, I'll add as well that states that have moved to computer very aggressively have basically had a huge influx of dollars, which are scarce, to bring everyone up to a certain standard, and we are not at that point. So it really makes it even more challenging. I've often said I'm kind of on a dock and one foot on the keel or the gunwale and one foot on the dock trying to determine where we're going to be with computerized testing as we move forward. It's a concern. I don't have a specific number. I'd be glad to get you what the METS report was to be able to see what that is. But it continues to be a concern, as you say.
I would appreciate that, Mr. Mattson. Thank you.
Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Mattson or Mr. Piquel and Ken, earlier you talked about one of the lessons of accountability having to do with the importance of aligning, holding students accountable and holding systems accountable. And of course, the world being what it is, you know, that my guess is that that's still, a disparate scenario. I'm wondering, we did a little bit of talking about this in the task force. One of the ways that we attempted to partly address this is to make sure, or at least to put forth the concept that we should be aligning a appropriate level of supports and appropriate types of supports relative to high accountability expectations for both systems and students. And we didn't come up with any formulas for how to do that. But I'm wondering if either one of you can say a little bit more about whether it's even possible or desirable to be able to develop metrics around aligning appropriate level supports with the desired outcomes relative to college and career readiness.
Who would like that question first? Mr. Piquel.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Mariani, there are two broad types of supports that, as you know, because you've been there, we've talked about on the group. One I've already talked about, and that's the dipstick test, the diagnostic tests, formative assessment that can be used earlier in a student's career to predict performance on the test to which you attach stakes. That's a source of support that if you talk to teachers around the state in particular, but also administrators, they're crying for. In some places, schools are using a test called the MAP, produced by an organization, Northwest Achievement Levels Association, to try and predict performance on our current MCAs. There also are certainly, as Dirk mentioned, many other strategies out there for doing it. So one strategy is the formative and diagnostic assessment. If you're not doing that, then very likely that kid is going to be, and his or her teachers are going to be very surprised at what he or she gets on an 11th grade math test, and that gives you 1 year to fix it. So that's the first kind of support. The second type of support, and this in part I think gets to the earlier question about using data, is professional development. One of the things our group has talked about is that the strategy that the legislature and the administration supported in creating regional math science academies, which have been focused on junior high mathematics, has actually been, at least anecdotally, which is to say I don't have data on this, very successful. The feedback from teachers who participated in that effort of bringing teachers together with higher ed institutions in regions of the state to look at instruction in junior high mathematics has been quite successful. And so one of the other things we've talked about is that, especially in these end of course areas, algebra 2, biology, suddenly we're talking about a very specific body of content. We ought to replicate that strategy and bring high school teachers and curriculum directors and other together with post-secondary education to do a similar type of academy structure where they're very, very focused on best practice instruction. And then there's a series of supports that I think, especially with our tradition of local control in Minnesota, we're always going to need to say again and again, optional, optional, optional. But if the state were either in partnership with a national vendor that we worked with or on our own, develop model course objectives, model course syllabi, performance examples of really rich, high-quality ways for teachers to help students succeed in those content areas, I think our problem would actually not be getting people to use them, but meeting the demand for them. So diagnostic assessments, professional development, and instructional tools like those course objectives and model syllabi, I think are some of the ways that we can get at that the carrot piece of the puzzle to help make sure students are ready to whack back the stick. I'm killing this metaphor, so I'll stop that. But so Representative Mariani, if you said what are the metrics of that, we ought to be able to track the degree to which the teachers who are teaching those high stakes classes, if ultimately the task force does recommend an end of course structure, we ought to be able to show over a period of years that we have gone to scale and provided every teacher that is faced with the challenge of making that high-stakes decision based on a test and classroom performance with those tools and professional development. We ought to track the number and the geographic dispersion of people who are receiving that level of support so that we know that it's not just certain schools that happen to just gravitate toward that kind of resource that are getting it, but that actually it goes to scale across the state.
Dr. Mattson would like a shot at this question.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, I guess with Kent going first, then it gave me some more time to think. Your question is very interesting about the metrics, too, and you know, there are things that we continually think about at the department about, boy, wouldn't it be neat to track or be able to just figure out if X is working? But the challenge for us at this point has been some of the data elements and tying those up. I know there's great effort happening now to start collecting course-taking practices and so on. One of the things we are continually asked for, even in the grad right now, is who has a system, a strategy for remediation that's working? So Kent's talked about putting in place the infrastructure to make sure things are going right. That's the basics. And then looking back and saying, is that enough support? One of those things could be being able to look back at the remediation programs that students have taken if they have not been successful. What were they? What kind of hours did they spend as either additional course hours? Now, all of this, though, has a lot of sound of additional record-keeping data elements. Now, there are some things that we can make easy, but somebody's still got to declare it was an extra 5 hours with Mr. Mattson after school at some point. So looking, tracking on, and there's been a lot of work to tie in the K-12 and the post-secondary data systems here in Minnesota, and we'll be able to track that as far as completion rate and so forth, too. How about the students that just got an additional 5 hours, or they got this type of program, or reading burst, or whatever it was? So that's one thing. And then something, too, that I think you'll certainly hear more about as we continue on in session is just being able to go back and ask the stakeholders, what supports are working for you. And I think that's something I know it reached your inbox here over the weekend as far as what are the teachers saying, what are the students saying about the level of support that is working? Is that helping? And are we finding some alignment between the satisfaction of those supports in the areas where we're finding that scores are improving? So our students that did have that was the critical program they implemented there, do teachers feel that that was enough? Yep, I find that that was appropriate support for me. So there's some elements to come behind that as well, I just add on to Kent's.
Representative Depke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is really for Mr. Pickell. Is mm-hmm. that how I pronounce it? Thank you. I wanted to go back for a moment to Representative Dietrich's point on access to technology. And on a global basis, you showed us earlier those slides of Korea and Australia and how far they've come within the last 5 to 10 years in terms of education. Do we know how that is tied to or what part access to technology has played in those countries to have those improvements with their student population?
Mr. Pickell?
Madam Chair and Representative, I will say that there are some international leaders who have invested heavily in information technology. And there are others that have not. And so it's very difficult to draw a causal link to say technology is the secret sauce that actually is going to produce that type of improvement. Everybody's investing now. And so it's a situation in which other countries are really working to make sure that, you know, for instance, laptops for every kid and things like that are actually not the exception, but they're the rule. But historically, a broad array of countries that have had very good educational improvements have not actually been using anything that's necessarily very sophisticated. It's great teaching and high-quality curriculum. One example of that, if I can give an example, and it's not focused directly on students, but it is on teachers. In Singapore, which is arguably maybe competing with Finland, the world superpower in educational performance, one of the things we worked with principals on in the Principals Academy is a case study of how they went from being basically a destitute country after World War II to being that superpower. And we talk about how literally the creation of a national repository on old VHS tapes of high-quality lessons aligned to their national standards, and of course it's a city-state, so their national standards are kind of like ours, has been was a critical, for 20 years, critical asset in their educational performance, because literally teachers went to central repositories, checked out these videotapes of high-quality lessons on the states, the same standards that they had to teach, and they could watch one of their colleagues give a model lesson on the national standards. That was a very, very now ancient use of technology to do what is so challenging to do in person and at scale, which is bring everybody together and put them all together and put them at tables and have coffee and cookies and stuff and then tell them all that. Whereas that was an example of just-in-time delivery of best practice professional development, leveraging a dated technology. That stuff is now starting to happen in just-in-time strategies using the web as well.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome, Representative. Representative Benson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just have kind of a brief little comment and then maybe a question that either the testifiers could deal with. I remember when I was teaching, one of the problems always, which was never solved, was how to accumulate good diagnostic information and to be able to apply it in a good time. It just never seemed to work. And I would just urge that people who are working on that issue concentrate on that even more than some of these other testing procedures. As far as technology, I do think it is a key, although I have a sense that Americans sometimes see problems and look for a technological fix. One of my old mentors, where I taught, used to say, learn the book, kid, first, and it's time on task. And when we see some of these countries, India, South Korea, and Seoul, China, having extended school days, a lot of expectations, not only from the school, but also the parents. There's a cultural issue concerned here. Saturday schools, and so those are areas that our country has chosen not to go, partly because of the financial implications. But I do think we tend to look for a technological fix for many of our problems, where some of them are societal. issues. The other thing, and I just want you to maybe visit a little bit about what I hear many teachers complaining about, the numbers of tests and the time that it takes for them. That's one. But the other one is sometimes the emphasis on objective tests, filling in the bubbles, which I think is forcing many teachers to teach to the test. And this has all kinds of implications, I think, for our society concerning creativity. And so greater emphasis on writing all the way through a child's time in school. I hear employers complaining about the fact that they have college graduates who can't write a decent memo. And so I'm just concerned about the notion that somehow if we just collect a lot of information and throwing it at somebody, we'll deal with all these problems. So I don't know. It's just a, kind of a general question I had for you about
who's brave enough to go for
testing.
That first? Dr. Mattson?
Madam Chair, Representative, so a couple of, you raised a number of points. I'll address just a couple of maybe. Couple of quick comments on. Certainly a number of tests is always, you know, a concern. I'm in charge of one set of tests, but it's not all the tests that students take within the state of Minnesota, right? So an average fifth grader or sixth grader is going to take one math test and one reading test for the state of Minnesota. But they are going to take a number of other tests, perhaps at a local level, depending upon that that local education agency. Certainly, the more we can bring those to alignment to one another, the better off we are. They serve different purposes, there's no doubt. They are an end-of-course test, even in its current form. The fifth-grade test is designed to be an end-of-course on all the math you were supposed to learn in fifth grade. So they serve different purposes, and there is, and you'll hear this, you've heard it from years before, there's no one test that's going to do it any more than the state buying one Toyota will serve to rebuild 35W and transport employees, etc. So
better make it a Honda now.
Yeah, that's a good point. One car, I guess I will, in my deference to Representative Growling's question, I won't name a contract. Fill in the bubble test, definitely. You know, we continue to work on, and I take a small modicum of pride in saying that the state in our science test is actually kind of nation-leading in how we develop tests to be aligned to what's going on in the classroom. And so we have interactive items that require students to basically interact as if they are in a science lab to some degree. We're planning to generate kind of another version or the next generation of that to go to simulations, essentially. These are not cheap tests to build, so we have to do them carefully and think well about, you know, what's prudent and what's financially prudent to get the right information out. To some degree, you know, test makers like myself will tell you there's a reason that the multiple choices stuck around so long is actually they're very efficient items. It doesn't mean you can measure everything by them, but I'll be the first one to say it, but they're cost efficient in some way, to sound cheap about it. So those are a couple of comments, but I think, as Kent says, we are looking at kind of the next generation of, there are always going to be these multiple choice items because there are some standards that are just very efficient to measure that way. But to do the next generation of 21st century skills and everything else that's coming, nobody knows better than the test makers that the bubble test is not going to do that test in and of itself. So there's a bundle of work to do. I don't know if you have any other comments.
Mr. Pickell?
I would just say, Madam Chair, Representative Benson, all three issues you touched on are ones we've spent a lot of time with, and I hope that there will be a recommendation of the Commissioner and ultimately to you that addresses your point about frequent diagnostic assessment, higher order thinking skills and creativity, and number of tests. So those are all issues that we really have grappled with, and we hope to recommend some meaningful, though not revolutionary, improvements that would address them.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome, Representative Benson. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was actually thinking quite a bit in the lines of the questioning and the thoughts of Representative Benson a moment ago. And they're kind of disjointed. I've got a lot of stuff going through my head right now. But I think the multiple measures, you made a comment about multiple measures being the best way to do an assessment, but also the ease of explaining to parents in the community what we're doing. And I think we're at that such a an important issue that we don't often deal with, I think, in the state and in the nation. We have to explain what we're going to test, but we also need to make certain, and that it's easy, that we make certain that we're testing the right things. And so I'm kind of going to tie this to some information I learned at a recent TIMSS meeting, or one of the TIMSS studied the results. And it has to do with multiple tests. It's not the multiple tests that is concerning to me, but it's we're assessing multiple issues and items. And I'm not necessarily sure that we're tying, when we measure ourselves internationally with the TIMSS results, the standards in the TIMSS results don't necessarily, in fact, we know they don't align with where we're teaching in the state of Minnesota, which then affects our MCA tests and our grad tests and on and on and on. And so I guess it's not just the number of assessments, but it's how the assessments are tied to standards. And are we looking globally so we can fix all this at once? And then that links to, and this is my distorted thinking, the comment that you made about the frustration among staff with the constant changes. And I can tell you, I'm in my other job, I'm the director of the Rochester Math Science Partnership. And I hear from the principals and the teachers, particularly the math and science area, that when we constantly change the standards, even though we're trying to improve them, that then changes the assessment, on and on and on. And you're constantly trying to change what you're teaching, but then the end goal keeps changing, and you never get where you're going to go. And it's very frustrating to our staff. So my last comment is that it's depth and breadth of education. When we're constantly teaching to a test, are we getting the depth and breadth of the education we need to our kids, or is the great history of quality education that Minnesota's always had in the effort to keep improving, are we ruining that? I worry a little bit that we're getting so focused on getting to an outcome on a test result that we're really losing the quality of great education we've always had, which is important with innovation and entrepreneurism and all the things that are beyond the score on a test. And I'll end with your comment, and I know this is all over the place, and I apologize, but with Finland and what Finland did, one of the things that I've heard so often from our teachers is does the state, and maybe you do and I don't know about it, and can we, in my job at home, provide a VHS, if you will, but a web-based best practice solution to the standards that are supposed to be taught, so every district isn't spending the time and money to write the curriculum to get the best response when the school district down the street is doing excellent in that, but they're not, you know, in a strand, for instance, on the testing. They have a really good program that's teaching kids, but there's no place for the rest of the state or the rest of the area to see that. So I know that's a lot, and I apologize for that, but I've been thinking as everyone's been talking, and it all just came out.
Mr. Pickell?
Madam Chair, Representative Norton, and members, amen. The fact that we're reinventing the wheel, a classroom at a time, a district at a time, a school at a time across the state, is, I think, among Minnesota's top three, and I'm not even sure what the other two challenges are educationally right now. If we do nothing else with this testing and accountability system, we ought to create a system that allows us to shine a light on success and replicate it. But that's going to take capacity building. That doesn't happen sort of just by accident. And so creating structures and mechanisms to do that, I think, is going to be very, very critical. To your larger point about teaching to the test and standards, Representative Benson and others have touched on this, it really starts with the standards. DIRK ultimately is paid to build a test to the standards. And I think that the lessons of high-performing countries around the world, and to some extent here in the United States, certainly the TIMSS study suggests that depth is more important than breadth, and fewer better standards are better. They're also harder to build tests to measure, standardized, low-cost tests to measure. When you are faced with the challenge you're going to be faced with, which is making a decision about whether we do or do not grant a kid a diploma, so a very high-stakes decision at an individual level, the point that many of you have raised is so essential, which is to say, what is the test trying to measure, and is that the right thing? An example. Colleague at the University of Minnesota, faculty member named Rob Warren, some of you you've heard from him, professor of sociology, he's become one of the leading researchers of high-stakes exit exams. His research has basically concluded that they harm certain kids without benefiting other kids. And so after starting looking at the issue a decade ago, really neutral, agnostic, he's come to a point where he's calling for change. The measure he uses, though, is the National Assessment of Educational Progress, the nation's report card, the NAEP, the national test, which is a test that's about 40 years old and was designed to measure long-term trends in student achievement. The question I would raise that illustrates the point about be clear about what the test is intended to measure is that high school exit exams were never designed to improve performance on NAEP. They were designed to improve performance on state standards measured by state tests. And so to look at the NAEP data, and what he's done is found that states that implement high-stakes exit examinations don't get an improvement on NAEP. Well, that is a concern. One would have hoped to have seen improvement on that additional measure. But to me, it's not conclusive because that's not what the test, the high-stakes test or exams were designed to do. They were designed to measure, in the case of the grad, mastery of Minnesota's academic standards. And so really being clear about what those standards are intending to measure and how well the test measures mastery of those standards is just an essential point, especially as we get into these very controversial and sometimes heated decisions that you all have to make in the coming months.
Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, thanks. Just a couple of quick comments to add on to Ken's. Excuse me. One is your point is exactly right. I often chat with folks at the department and say you can have something relatively fair, and it's going to be complex because we're dealing with students in various systems, or you can have something very uncomplex, but it's probably not going to be as fair. There's a very fine balance between those two, and that's always the tension in assessment, but more so in accountability, because you have these features of does this student get a reprieve for X amount of time, etc. So the more of those explanations you have to do, the more complex it becomes, but some would argue more fair. The issue about the test continually changing, and Kent's right, we're required to build a test built line to state statute, or excuse me, state standards, and the revision of those are in state statute. And so hopefully, I'm hopeful with you because we are very busy as well building to them. I often tell the story of before one student ever took the science test and we knew how a student was going to do on that test in one item, the other areas were already at work revising the science, and you know full well from your role there. So the last thing about, you know, the video-based element, I know there was some work, this wasn't all in my realm, but I know there was some work within our Race to the Top application, and even beyond that, that was work that was going on already to do Apple iTunes University and try and do the very same thing of the videotape only brought 24/7 to your home computer or wherever you'd like to have it. So hopefully some of those things, there's a lot of fingers moving forward. It's just hopefully they're all moving at the right common rate, I guess.
So, members, we have a number of members who have questions, and we have about 5 minutes left. So I'm going to ask if you can crystallize your question, and we can keep the answer short. Obviously, the wealth of material here is beyond the capacity for us to fully address in an hour and a half. So, Representative Newton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Like Representative Norton, I have a lot of things going through my mind. But one, you know, we're very concerned with the achievement gap, and your bar chart showed very dramatically that we do have a major achievement gap. But can we separate out, for example, our African American students from Black English language learning students to see, you know, are the students who have been born in the country, are from families who were born in the country, doing better if they're in one of the subgroups than families that are of ELL parents or ELL students themselves?
Dr. Mattson.
Madam Chair, Representative Newton, we can do that level of disaggregation. So we can tell you what students, but the only disaggregation we can do is that which is reported by district and is either required through state or federal mandate. So we can say here's the number of Black students who are non-ELL, and this is their performance. There is certainly, first of all, there's going to be a whole new racial coding process that's coming by federal requirement very shortly. But beyond that, there are certainly commonly requests for, we'd like to know in the Somali community, where is it? And I've been asked this, and I've turned back to the question and said, I can't provide that to you. I don't have a identifier for Somali. So we can do some of that level, but we don't have, at least at the data systems and data collections we have, the ability to do that. The achievement gap certainly is a constant request for more fine-grained analysis of those types of questions. So,
thank you.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We listened to a speaker the other day who thought the solution for learning and education was ungraded system. that our grades indeed cause problems. And, you know, in when we're testing, let's say fifth graders, we're assuming that all fifth graders, their brains are developed, their maturation is there, and there's a variation in ages, et cetera, but yet we expect the same thing for all of them on those tests. Do you think that there is some ability to look at, or what would you think about examining the issue of ungraded and having a system that's 0 to 21? And when students are ready for those kinds of tests, they take them.
Dr. Metz?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson. So to some degree, the reason we have the graded test, well, first of all, I'll start out with saying a colleague of mine constantly reminds me the reason we have grades is so we can send kids to lunch. That's his comment. So we can organize the system and move through. I think to some degree he may not be all wet there. Secondly, and seriously, the NCLB, as you know, requires us to do grade level testing at each of those grades. However, there is. Certainly, we've been moving toward growth measures, being able to define growth. I'm very anxious to see what happens in the reauthorization of ESEA, because I think there's a lot of conversation that growth is going to be certainly a prominent area in there. So what would I think of it? I think it's very apparent to anybody who's been in the classroom that all of your fifth graders don't arrive at the end of the year at the same point. And part of how we're restructuring the 3-8 system in assessment is trying to accommodate to that as well. The other thing I'll quickly say, though, is to be able to demonstrate that growth, those standards have to be very well articulated all the way through. So, for example, our current reading language arts assessments have main idea in every grade except seventh grade. And so we as test makers look at that and say, well, what do we align a question to in main idea? Certainly they didn't think it was unimportant in seventh grade. It's just that we lost that articulation. That's a simple example of saying how well that needs to be articulated in the learning progression so that we can demonstrate those things that are a little bit broader than just we all got to hear on May 20th at the end of fifth grade.
Mr. Piquel.
Very briefly, Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, my opinion is that philosophically and intellectually, that'd be very interesting. But the whole point of my remarks was that the goal of our effort has been, and I think the goal of our state should be, college and career readiness. For the foreseeable future, definitely my lifetime, and I'm well into my 40s, so I'm not done yet, but it's been here a while, the University of Minnesota is going to continue to give tests and grades. And employers are going to continue to evaluate employees based upon hopefully multiple measures, but still measures. And so if we're serious about preparing kids for the real world after high school, despite what we might wish, the reality of it is those kids have got to understand a system in which though they are accountable for their own performance. The critical issue is those grades need to mean something. They need to be aligned with other measures of performance. And as Dirk said, they need to be coherent over time as kids progress through school.
Thank you. There are a few others on here, but I'd like to give the last question to the official chair of this committee, Representative Mariani, just because...
Well, Madam Chair, thank you. I'll take advantage of that. but I won't pose a question because we are going to go over time if I do. I guess first I do want to thank Dr. Mattson and Mr. Piquel for not only being here today, but for their tireless leadership, quite frankly, over the course of many months since this last legislative session in terms of helping to guide a pretty diverse group of just terrific Minnesotans through some really big, broad, complex, interrelated issues here. And I will kind of give you a teaser, you know, that as complex and as big and as important as this decision is, this committee will at some point, hopefully sooner than later, be formally asked to weigh in on this issue of Common Core, National Common Core Standards. And I think it's important that we understand, at least from my perspective, that as Minnesotans, it's critically important for us to be able to lay out a vision that follows many of the principles I think that have been laid out here, principles around the stability of state policy, of you know, this balance between sanctions and incentives, of death versus breath. I mean, all the principles that we laid out here, that we come up with something that articulates clearly our will as a state, and that we use that clear articulation as part of our vetting process with the Common Core Standards requests that will be coming forward. I just really, Madam Chair, really appreciate you allowing me to sit back and relax a bit and be much more reflective here. And I want to thank you, gentlemen, for your leadership. And we'll be hearing, hopefully, we'll be hearing a formal recommendation from the Department of Education relative to this issue, and at some point, hopefully, entertaining a bill that responds to that. So thank you again, gentlemen. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome, Representative Marion. With the privilege of the chair, I just have one closing thought, and that's I've been sitting here looking at the moonwalker, which I presume is Neil Armstrong, reflecting on the phrase, just pick a system and stick to it. If you think of the wealth of the discussion we've had here today, I would say we have our challenge cut out for us, and I hope that we'll all rise to the challenge of being open to the data and really being very reflective and thoughtful about the process. With that, the meeting is adjourned.